Okay, thank you. So, I want to tell you about some recent results in testing this effective theory of large scale structure. This is work I've done with these people here, including Emmanuel, who's a student and is somewhere in the audience, perhaps. So in the last few years, I've also done a lot of work with Leonardo, and I know that he will talk about this tomorrow. And so what I will try to report in this talk are things that I've done independently, so with the people here, trying to test some of these ideas. So the outline of the talk is as follows. I will give a short introduction as to why we are wasting our time thinking about these kind of things for a little while. And then I will tell you about the results of tests of these EFT ideas in Lagrangian space and Eulerian space and some other simplified IR resummation formula. I don't know how, perhaps I don't have time to go through all the things. I don't know. So whenever it gets towards 2:30, I'll just stop. So let me spend a few minutes with the introduction. This perhaps is not needed for me to say this to this audience, but we are moving into an era in which we are hoping to extract a lot of new information from large-scale structure surveys. And the one point that I want to make is that the CMB has made constraints that are so accurate that anything that the CMB has already measured, if the large-scale structure is going to do better than that for that particular observable, then it will have to be done with very accurately. So the bar is very high, at least for those things that the CMB has already constrained. Not everything. The CMB has not constrained everything, so there are things still that are quite open, like first stars or the epoch of ionization, in which even order of magnitude kind of predictions are good enough. But for a lot of things, that's no longer the case. So for example, just to give you some example, some of us have, for a long time, were very interested in primordial non-Gaussianities. And so here, this is just a plot that shows you the relative corrections from some FNLs.
You said you're not interested anymore?
No.
You said you were interested.
We have been interesting.
Okay.
Well, okay. So yeah. So well, what is true is that it'll take quite a while to make the constraints from Planck, constraints that are better from the ones from Planck. But so just to make this point, so let's take FNL type numbers that from Planck, the upper limit. So what are the typical corrections to the density or in the large scale structure coming from FNLs of order, the ones that are of the size of Planck around, say, the nonlinear scale, somewhere around 0.1 at redshift 0, there are percent or sub-percent effects. If you want to do 10 times better than Planck, you're talking about very small things, right? So in other words, the nonlinearities, this is the relative correction of the primordial nonlinearities over the nonlinearities from gravitational evolution, okay? So they're getting very, very so improving on Planck means very that you have to do things very, very accurately. Now, you can try to stay at large scales where the effects might be larger, but then you have a small number of modes. So there's in the large scale structure, in order to probe FNLs of order one, which are the ones at least that you say 10 times better than Planck, you read a lot of modes. You really need to go to very close to as closer as you can to the nonlinear scale, and there the effects compared are very small. So so clearly one needs to do things very accurately if that's the goal. But everything that people want to do with large scale structure these days requires sub-percent precision, right? Dark energy constraints, neutrino masses, they're all about things that are sub-percent, right? So of course, as I was saying, there are other things like epoch of ionization that is not like this, but there are a lot of questions that now are in the sub-percent regime. And so what we've been trying to do is try to see how far one can understand the development of nonlinearities in large-scale structure from an analytic point of view, you know, at the most precise level that we can. I mean, there's a long history to this that I don't want to go into. There's standard calculations of the development of large-scale structure. These are results from the literature standard perturbation theory. You can do linear theory and corrections, and what you discover is you do the calculation in the standard way. You don't see, things do not seem to improve as you improve more orders, even though at a scale like this one, for example, where you can see linear theory one loop to this, the actual result, so things do not seem to be converging. If you just do the correlation coefficient between the density field in the simulation and the Seldovich, it's just almost one. So the thing is not particularly difficult to figure out what is happening. It's not too different from the initial conditions. But however, there's something wrong about the way we were doing this kind of calculations. And you know, there's a lot of ways to see that there's some problems. Here's just some examples from the literature. The whole point is that perturbation theory is not really converging to the right answer on small scales, and it's not about summing more terms. The series just doesn't converge. I think this is from the paper by Matt McQueen, which in 1D you can do it and you sum the whole series and you can see that the sum of the, it's not about the series not including enough terms, it's just that the series does not converge. You can do the spherical collapse and solve it as if it were perturbation theory, and you see that the various loops they don't converge. And if the last point that I wanted to make about this is, I mean, we all know that on small scales what happens is that halos form, and we all know the form, I mean, the simple mass function, Preschecter mass function is e to the minus this delta c square over sigma square of m. The power spectrum is in the denominator. So clearly this is something that cannot be expanded in powers of the power spectrum because it's 1 over the power spectrum in the denominator of the exponential. So any effects to do with the halos, clearly perturbation theory is just not expandable. So it's obviously not going to work. So on small scales, perturbation theory cannot really work. But however, when we are doing this type of calculations in perturbation theory, one is doing these loop integrals where one is integrating over momenta that are high, or the run over all momenta, and on small scales you're putting some result which is not correct, and so this pollutes as you include higher and higher loops, even pollutes more and more the results even on large scales. For example, if you just look at the integrand, for example, you can compute the linear theory power spectrum, the one loop, the two loop. So if you compare the integrand of the one loop P13 with the integral of the one loop P15, where is the contributions coming from? You see something like this. For P13, this is where what are the momenta running in the loop that make most of the contribution. It's peaked around here, and it's decaying as you go to smaller scales. As you go to even higher loops, it picks more and more of its contribution from small scales, which are more, as I was arguing, very wrong. And so this is why as you go to higher loops, the whole thing doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. But and even you can see, I mean, these are kind of things we all know about. If you just, you know, if you look at an embodied simulation, the particles end up in some sort of halo. If you look at where they end up in the Seldovich approximation in 2LPT and so on, they just, you know, they go towards there. But it's not that as you go to more orders in perturbation theory, they get any closer to here. They just go around like crazy, and it's not going to work, right? So this is so there's some irreducible mistake that you're making, and okay, that's, you have to somehow track it. The good part, however, is that things tend to stay together. So we are making the mistake
So I mean, this is exactly what you mentioned, e to the minus delta c squared over sigma. That looks like an instanton type effect. But shouldn't you do that basically? Like find, instead of doing perturbation theory, basically find these instantons or things like that.
When I gave you all of these examples, these are different ways in which the thing is failing, and indeed for some of these is something like the halo model. I mean, this part is what we would call a stochastic term in this perturbation theory that we cannot really not predict, and it has some. But there are other parts that enter in different ways that one can keep track of. So
I want to understand what you just said. The halo is an instant term. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, or a solid term or something. So the point is, I guess, the reason I said that is that this type of terms, exponential of minus one over a coupling constant, those are things non-perturbative effect. So the coupling constant in this case is the amplitude of perturbation. And exponential of minus one over that are the kind of things you get from it. So they're non-perturbative effects. You cannot get from analytic expansion.
Yeah. So,
but that's not exactly.
It's not that, yeah, it's not that it's an
instant.
No, it's just that it has similar.
It's not similar at all.
Instant time in the sense that these are like classical solutions. Like these halos are classical solutions to the Poisson motion, and they're classical static solutions to the Poisson motion. So instant time is not really the right word for it, but if you read, and, but also field theory might not be the right word for what you're doing either. So I think in the same sense that you're doing field theory, this might be basically non-perturbative solution or talent point.
Yeah, so
it's called
the halo.
Gravitational dynamics.
Yeah, so. I think we all understand the physics that's going on. I don't think I'm trying to say that there's anything different in terms of what is actually going on. We've run these simulations. We've looked at this for a long time. I'm just trying to understand how these effects that are clearly something that I cannot capture with the perturbation theory, how they are polluting my perturbation theory so I can, I mean, to see if there's any hope of including them or understand them. That's the goal. Things form halos. And the halo, I mean, to the extent, let me skip that. Okay, so the kind of summary of the situation is that perturbation theory does not converge to the right answer on small scales. It's not a question of adding more loops or something. It just doesn't do it. Loops receive contributions from these small scales, and the problem is even more and more important as you compute higher and higher loops. So these problems are, you know, become worse and worse. And this is the reason why, as you think, you do a lot of work to do two loops, and the whole thing is much worse than if you just did linear theory. So if you just do naively. And there are these non-perturbative effects. All of these things are true. This idea of this effective theory of large-scale structure is to try to capture these effects from the small scales. Of course, we cannot compute them. The whole point I'm just saying is not something we can compute. It can be computed perhaps with a simulation, or it can be measured with the data, but it's trying to understand the form of these mistakes, how it depends on k, and so on. This is the idea. This is not, for people in this room, this should not be particularly surprising kind of approach. We've done this for the bias for a very long time, for the bias of objects. So there we understand very well, for example, that if you go to sufficiently large scales, the overdensity of some tracer should be a bias that goes to a constant on large scales, and it can depend on the density or the Laplacian of the potential, but it cannot depend, say, on 1 over k squared, and we use this, or 1 over, it cannot depend on phi. We use this, for example, for testing the FNL local non-Gaussianity. Regardless of the formation of the halos, of the galaxies, or whatever, if you go to sufficiently large scales, you know, gravity cannot produce a phi here. It has to be an observer. It has to be Laplacian of phi. Same story is this EFT is kind of the exact same story. You can think of the calculations that you do in standard perturbation theory as a biased version of the true density field, just like the galaxies are a biased version of. So the reason of the bias is the inability of perturbation theory to get the right answer on small scales, just as kind of the small scale physics is the reason for this bias. So it's very analogous. And this EFT is just telling us things about the properties of these Bs, analogous to the fact that in the case of bias, you cannot have bias times phi. It's the same, okay? And in this particular case, it boils down to saying, I mean, at the lowest order, that this bias has to start with k squared times delta matter. And the k squared, I mean, this goes back to some people's book, or perhaps even before, but you can find it in the 1980 people's book. You don't have B doesn't is a it has to be one go to one because of mass conservation. It cannot have a K because of momentum conservation, and so it has to start any corrections from whatever you do on small scale has to start with a K square. That is if you want the lowest order. Mistake. So all I'm saying is that the not understanding of the what happens on small scales can only pollute the perturbation theory at lowest order by a term that goes like k squared times delta with a free coefficient that depends on the small physics, the small scale physics that you don't know, just like the bias is a free coefficient. And however, if you go to higher loops or if you calculate three-point functions and so on, there's a whole structure of how these different biases and what they look like as a function of k and so on that you can learn how it goes. And this is what this this EFT is. So what I want to do now is to tell you about some tests that we've done recently of these ideas. So we just wanted to understand. So as just like the bias, if you go, this works at sufficiently large scales. So in practice, we want to understand up to what scales these ideas work. Where is the place where this expansion doesn't make any sense anymore? Where is the nonlinear scale? And also the mistakes that you, or the accuracy of the calculations, how does it scale with k as you go to larger and larger scales? We did some. When you're doing these tests, you're kind of it's difficult to decide exactly how to do it, in the sense that if you go to small scales close to the nonlinear scale, but you don't know exactly what the nonlinear scale actually is, where this theory fails, you don't know where it is you're trying to discover. But you go there, these effects are very big, but you don't know if what you're seeing there, you're trying to constrain those parameters, but at the same time, the whole thing is supposed to fail, so you don't know if you're just fooling yourself. If you go to very large scales, the effects are very small, and so it really pays to try to compare these things on a realization by realization basis. You take a simulation, you compute what this EFT is supposed to tell you for that box, so you don't have any cosmic variance, and you try to measure. To measure those parameters and see to what extent this thing works. So these are just standard formulas for. The first thing we did was look at just the displacement of particles in a simulation. So these are the standard formulas for the Lagrangian perturbation theory. This fails in the exact same way as I was discussing before. So from the small scale effects. So these terms you need to add. You know, these free terms are kind of new forces that you have to add there, which kind of boil down to thinking of these regions in Lagrangian space as finite objects that have some shape, and so they have a quadrupole and they generate gravity through their quadrupole and so on. So, okay, I'm not going to go into detail as to exactly the how this EFT works. I just want to talk, I want to say it in slightly a different way. Okay, so think of the initial conditions of the simulation. Okay, so and think of computing the potential for this displacement field in perturbation theory. In perturbation theory, you get a linear, second order, third order. Okay, so you have this very large dimensional space of the displacement vector, and you are computing specific vectors. You know, the first order, the second order, and so on. You can think of us trying to, you have the final displacement of the simulation, and you're trying to see to what how it projects on these displacement fields that you can compute with perturbation theory. Okay, so for example, this is the linear theory Seldovich, then the second order 2LPT, and so on. They just give you a specific vector in this very large dimensional space of the result of the simulation, and you're just trying to see, you know, perturbation theory is telling you all of these coefficients should be one, and this EFT is basically telling you that because of the mistakes that you make on the small scales, in effect, these are like biases which start with one but have some corrections. The lowest one that I discuss is like that. So when you do perturbation theory, for example, the Zeldovich, the tree level is just you take the first order and square it. If you do one loop, you have two terms. You have the second order square or the first order times the three, and so on. Okay, so the different. So you have to do third order times the one is the same order as this. If you look at this, you notice that, for example, at the one loop, you do have to calculate the three, but all that you're caring about is how the three correlates with the one, right? So in reality, when you go to one loop, you have these two vectors, the Zeldovich and the second order 2LPT, and you're asking to what extent the solution that you got lives in this space. And the perturbation theory is telling you that the coefficient of the projection along the one, you know, it tells you how to compute it, okay? It's the 1,3. So all of these terms are really just the projections of the different orders in perturbation theory along the one direction. These are all along the two. These. So at one loop, you only care about the one and two vectors, and at two loop, you want two and three, and so on. Because the four here, you only care about how it projects on the two, the five, how it projects on the one. So these are things that are very easy to measure. These things are very easy to measure in the simulation. You just correlate, you compute 2LPT, 3LPT, and so on. You correlate the final answer with that. And perturbation theory is telling you the shape of this A1 of K should be the sum of 1 plus P13 over P11 plus P15 plus P17 plus P19. So it tells you something. The EFT is telling you, in addition to that, there are some mistakes from the short scales that look like that. So for this purpose, let's just look at one slice. So in principle, these transfer functions are different at different times, of course. But I can go to some length as to how many. The time dependence does not enter arbitrarily, but let's just look at one slice for the point. So these are examples. So these are the A1 measurements and the A2 measurements, how they compare with these predictions. And the point of this paper was to show that you clearly see this K-square correction. You can get the amplitude of it and so on, something that has no cosmic variance, really. So here you can see this is a plot of the ratio of the power spectrum of the model over the power spectrum nonlinear, the relative difference. You can see this is, one is Zeldovich and so on. This one is this EFT calculation. You can see on large scales we match mode by mode very, very well, and eventually it starts. Here is where the thing is breaking, and we were trying to test where this point was. This is another way of looking at the same thing. The power spectrum of the difference between the, in that particular box, of the predicted predicted density or displacement field in this case over the nonlinear one, and you can see so there are two things. As you include more terms, perhaps you can make predictions better on smaller scales, but also more importantly, the size of the mistake scales with the k. So here is the place where perturbation theory will somewhere here is the place where perturbation theory will no longer work. But as you include more loops, perhaps you move this a little bit, but more importantly, at a fixed k over here, your mistake is going down. I mean, this is 10 to minus 4, 10 to minus 5. So this is really, this is redshift 0. All of these are redshift 0. Of course, it gets better with redshift higher, but I mean, everything moves. It's not. Now there is a piece, this non-perturbative piece, the piece coming from the halos. How big is it? We were trying to figure out how big it was. I mean, this perturbation theory, this Peebles arguments tells you the mistake, how it needs to scale with k as you go on large scales. It needs to scale as k to the fourth. It's difficult for us to. So what we actually saw that it was that as you keep increasing the order in perturbation theory, there comes a point in which there's nothing that correlates you cannot make it better. There's like a floor of the mistake coming from, we think this, I mean, okay, we couldn't explain the mistake, and its shape looks quite reasonable. Its amplitude also looks like, in the case of the displacement, just the sum of the number of halos times something of the size of the virial radius. If you just add this, you can say, okay, this is my guess of how big these errors in the displacement might be. It also, you know, it's consistent with what we were seeing here, the shape and so on. So, okay, we think we have identified how big this was, but and then you can ask the question about, so for example, if you
what you
don't know from the halo model. So if we go back, so if this indeed, so there's first the question, is this all the mistake coming? Is the mistake just the halos? I think probably the mistake is bigger than that, but let's just take the mistake that just comes from the halos. So it's easy from the halo model to know, roughly speaking, how many halos there are of a given mass. But then the mistake that you see here, which is the mistake in the size of where the things end up, is more about perturbation theory than about n-body, because in the n-body, the thing just pretty much get to a much smaller place than. So this is the sum over halos of the typical mistake that perturbation theory makes, which is, you know, a couple of virial radius, but it's more a statement about the perturbation theory mistake that you make in each halo.
Size of a halo
is the size. I would say for sure the perturbation theory is not going to resolve the good thing in the halo. So this thing has to be bigger than the virial radius of the halo. Two times, we put two and it more or less works. Two times, four, I don't know. So it's not something I can really compute, but. I mean, I know what it is from the integral of this, and I just mentioned this to say that the shape is sounds okay, and the size is not unreasonable because, but okay. So the other thing that we did was to, if you imagine, so you can take, you can ask the question how well you do for the density. So this is, again, the power spectrum of the error. You just look at this line over here. This is kind of the analog in this language of a two-loop calculation of the density field on a realization-by-realization basis. This is a 1% error. This is the k at which you make a 1% error. This is the linear theory. One of these lines is, this one is kind of one loop, and this is kind of two loop. This is what we were finding.
Another question. Did you have something that would characterize shell crossing in
the
question? I don't remember, or not.
This is, in a sense, these parameters, this is what they are doing.
Okay.
I mean,
shell crossing is characterized.
Well, there is some free, the k-square piece, that's what kind of is, okay. And we also tried to investigate how big this mode coupling was in the, in this Eulerian space. Let me just skip that for a moment. So, now these results are a little bit, they were a little bit less optimistic than other than things that Leonardo and I were doing before. And Leonardo. This was just taking the best possible displacements and then going, this is like, we had the box and the simulation. The simulation moves the particle in some way. Our Lagrangian theory moves it in some other way, and we just then computed the density in this way. So, of course, the calculations that were done before were not done in this way. We were done just by solving just the Eulerian equations directly with some. You can show that all of the mistakes that these mistakes come from. You can incorporate by adding some sort of stress tensor on small scales, which you don't know what it is, but you model in terms of these free parameters. So this is how so we also try to do that.
Can you go back?
Yeah.
Modeling in terms of what's free parameters.
So this tau ij is it's a tensor, and it needs to so it can have two pieces. It can have some stochastic unpredictable piece, which, okay, this is, but then it can be that this tau ij responds to the long wavelength modes. So So in other words, this is a fluid with some generalized stress tensor that can have a part, because of the small scale, a part that you cannot predict, but a part which, if you think of, could be the average of the small scales in the background of the long ones that you're tracking, and you need to say how the tau ij depends on the long wavelength mode. And there you just use the most general thing that you can write, the most general tensor that you can write in terms of the long wavelength mode. For example, the first term would be di dj of the phi long with some parameter. Okay, here, this is the CS term, or you can put delta ij times Laplacian of phi long. These are what enters at the one loop. And then you can write quadratic things and cubic things, but you just write everything consistent with the fact that this has to be an observable. You cannot write here phi, basically. Delta ij phi is not. So it needs to have at least two derivatives. If you put more derivatives, the thing gets smaller. So it's an expansion of in derivatives and an expansion in the number of phis that you put. And so you know up to a given order how many terms you need to keep. And you know it gets one. So for example, if you need to put for two loops, you need to put quadratic terms. For example, there are three of them. Like, for example, well, there are three of them, and there's even more cubic terms. But so you really need to put them on. Some of them, most of them are, for example, at the one loop, these are the two ones that you have to put, but they do the exact same. They just come added together into the final answer of the power spectrum. They just change the power spectrum by some term which looks like k squared times some length square times p linear of k. So your mistake looks like this. Is the sum of these two coefficients, because just same thing happens here. A lot of them are similar in the term at the end of the.
So, what can you tell me about number?
So the number, this the is basically one, yeah, one megaparsec, roughly speaking.
Well, that depends upon the region. These are
no.
This,
so
this,
so
this
so
this is like a constitutive relation.
Yeah, exactly. But in reality,
they're trying to measure the constitutive parameter.
Yeah.
And so.
So depending on the region would be the second order thing. Because,
right. Yeah, right, because so, you've taken it linearly.
Yeah, so the linear one would be.
So what can you tell me about the term? Have you got a physical interpretation of what those numbers are?
Yeah. This is, this is kind of, two contributions to this. So let's take the case of in this Lagrangian perturbation theory. You divide the space into little regions and you follow each of these regions. As you follow them, they deform. Okay, these terms has two parts. First, the small scale motion changed the size of the region, and so this is just one contribution to this is the RMS size from the small scale modes. And the other one is the response of this RMS size to a long wavelength mode. So those are the two things that end up into here. And I can derive it to you easily later, because if not, I will. But yeah, so that's the two terms. And yeah, so if you want.
So it can only be.
And it stops as a quadrant.
Because this isn't going to be.
Yeah. So.
So let me say it in slightly different terms. So the tau ij is trying to capture the heat content of a halo.
No, so a halo would be good if we could get there. I don't think it's even,
Right, so some, this is delta V, delta
Maybe a few megaparsecs, 10 megaparsecs, a few megaparsecs, yeah. The region, the minimum region we can, so we are asked how small you can get, not halo.
But as you go, let's say you go into a supercluster region or a proto-supercluster or something, then that's going to be more dynamically active than a void-like.
Yeah, this would be this would be a second order.
But you think that that's captured essentially by by the tide?
Well, once I go to second order, I can write things, you know, it has to be,
Okay.
It has more complicated.
That's my point.
We write everything that it can, okay, so at least two derivatives on phi, indices constructed such that I and j, you know, are left over, that's it. So every term, so I think The problem is that as you go to sufficiently small scales, all of these terms become equally large, and then it doesn't work anymore. So this theory is a derivative expansion, and so it has like a wall. The nonlinear scale is a wall. We're not going to pass by putting more modes, putting more terms. All that you're really doing is getting the mistake down, scaling with. So there's some mistake that you're making that scales with k over k nonlinear, say in a scaling universe, to some power. The more of these terms, the higher loops you go, there's a consistent way in which you know how many you have to put and so on. You end up increasing this guy. But by the time you get to k nonlinear, the mistakes are one, and there doesn't. So, you know, you do the mistake as you go to more loops, they become steeper and steeper functions of k over k nonlinear, but there's some k star, k nonlinear here is disaster. So this is not something that will allow you to go on this side. It's just something that if you need precision by going, if you put more loops, you need to move less to get the same precision. So that's what this is. It's not to get here, no. Okay, so I'm running out of time, so let's... okay, so we did this blah, blah, blah test, and... Okay, you can read the paper. Oh yeah, so let's say it's less optimistic. So my current understanding is that at redshift zero, if I have to put some number somewhere between, it's roughly around between 0.2 and 0.3 that you get 1% mistake if you do a calculation to two loops. So that's my current understanding. So, and there's a lot of discussion in this paper, but I don't really have time. Let me.
So do you think that number is the same in Hilbertian theory?
Oh, we also, you know, I did it in the Lagrangian, but then also to double check. And now this is the same calculation. These results are not from doing Lagrangian and moving, but it's just the same calculation as the Eulerian from the very beginning, and I think it gives consistent results with the other thing. Yeah, we can go into the exactly why, but it doesn't matter. At this point, it doesn't matter. So, let me just advertise one more thing. I'm running out of time. So you can see this is the power spectrum that of the simulation over the power spectrum of the model, one loop, two loop. But you can see this oscillatory residuals, that has to do with the BAO and the smoothing of the BAO. This is something you can correct very well by doing the so-called IR resummation that we introduced with Leonardo. All I want to say is that we managed to simplify these formulas very much. So in one of these papers, you can find a very simplified formula where if you want to, so these effects of the smoothing are something that is completely captured within perturbation theory because it's really of the IR modes, of the long distance mode. And you know, there, with Leonardo, we had some complicated formulas, but I think they are similar to some, they give the same answer as some simply much simpler version than, I'm just advertising that they now exist in some papers. So, so let me summarize to say that, I think we are gaining more and more understanding of these various different terms in this effective theory, how well they approximate things, up to what scale, how they scale the mistakes with k over k nonlinear. I think the state-of-the-art calculation Leonardo has done at two loops for the power spectrum. There's one loop bispectrum calculation. So I think we understand quite much better things. There's still a lot of, I think there's still conceptual things that we don't, or at least I don't understand to my satisfaction. So I think it's an interesting set of problems. But anyway, I think Leonardo will give you also more advertisement later. Okay, I'll stand there.
So, I mean, it's kind of like what Dick was getting at and what you said, this k of k on an e, you can't look past it. So, is this somewhat like, it seems like it's a scheme-dependent statement, right? You've chosen to do like a cutoff type type regularization you've chosen to expand in K. But you know, if you use some different way of looking at things, like for example with Woodrow Kaiser, like you know that you can go, it doesn't blow up at shell crossing in the same way that Zeldovich does. And it's not the same type of regularization scheme as using momentum regularization like this. So could it be that there are other ways of doing things that are better if you use a different type of expansion?
I will not discard this. So I hope there is. So now let me say a couple of things. First, you mentioned cutoff dependence and so on. In fact, it's the other way around. If you do the calculation in perturbation theory, in the standard perturbation theory, I mean, another way of this of discovering that you really need all of these counterterms is to look at the UV sensitivity or the cutoff sensitivity of the standard calculation, and you will see that it depends on the cutoff, and these are exactly the terms needed so that the whole result is independent of how you put the cutoff. So in fact, you know, for power law spectrums, the perturbation theory even diverges, and so you need to, these are all the terms you would need to regularize the whole thing. So that's, but now, I think the more important question is, could there be something that allows you to go in this but, you know, of course, I mean, zeroth order simulation is moving. There's nothing magic. It's just about, now, what I like about this approach is the fact that I think from first principle, I understand the shape of everything. So it's not a phenomenological model, okay? So I know from mass and momentum conservation and the equivalence principle, the shape of all of these mistakes. So if that is of use for something, because you want to do precision and so on, then you know that's a good thing. Now, if you just are trying to push in this direction, probably you don't care so much to be able to get to 10^-4 and understanding everything. It's much better to have a phenomenological model, the halo model, that I mean describes what's going on. You measure the halo shape within the simulations. You plug it in. You count the halo, and you go in this direction. But it's a phenomenological model. Nothing wrong with it. But you probably cannot expect from it better than, you know, percentage kind of accuracy. You start having to put epicycles, and you don't really know if the epicycles you're putting, you know, are just for fitting or what. So I mean, it's just two different motivations. But I'm sure
So for galaxies, you know, mass and momentum conservation might not be good. Assumptions, and so how much of this do you think will generalize, you know, the threshold bias tracers that we care about?
Yeah, so indeed, for bias tracers, you can write down, you know, the similar kind of logic is, you know, this general, you know, like look at the paper by Pat McDonald and descendant from that, where you write everything, and indeed things do not start with a 1 plus k squared, but start with b0. So indeed. So, but yeah, this we know. And so, yeah.
So then do you have any optimism about
optimism about, I think, should I care about what?
Well, so, you know, those of us who can run simulations, should we care about Aquinas DFT formalism?
Well, you know, as you know, when we ask people of simulations, including the person that is asking the question, to run a simulation that's accurate on these scales, he gives us the thing and it's kind of all... So, anyway, so, you know... So, you know, it's very nice, these simulations, but you don't believe the simulations are correct, right? So you need to... At what level, right? So, for example, if you really want to know something at the 10^-4 level. Are your simulations, how do you know, right? So this is just one, the minimal you could care about this as that if you did a two loop, you have to be better than this. And if you don't, you start suspecting either the calculation. So you can use it for this if you want. I don't think, you know, the simulations are great, and people should run the simulations. I don't mind. Yeah, it's great.
You don't mind.
I don't mind. Look, I'm not an observer. Let me just say something. I'm not an observer, right? I'm not an observer. And there are two classes of observers, the observers of the real universe and the observers of the simulated universe. And I'm neither of them, okay? So you run the simulation, you observe. Now, when it's a simulated universe, you can look from the side and you can do the thing. I don't like observing. I mean, if not, I would go to the real telescope.
So could I pursue this?
Come on. I'm Donald Trump.
I want to compliment you on cola and E-cola, and that those things have been used rather effectively, it seems, in trying to do Mars.
But how did we figure it out? I mean, this...
This is the point I want to get at. So these codes have been made publicly available. I think the Australian people are the most recent. And their comment is, whatever you do, at the beginning, you have to go in and try and tune parameters, which is essentially your stopping parameters. And so those are sort of global parameters. So... maybe I'll put it another way. Would you encourage people who are making mocks to use something like E-cola, or is it going to always give sufficiently fundamental problems?
I think, galaxy formation problem. Yeah, I think it's very good. Things like cola in different ways. Somebody can, we got into doing that from this perspective because we're doing calculation this way, and then we're seeing this, and we're thinking, this is our way of getting there. And something. So perhaps, that's how we do it. I don't know, other people, so it's a motivational thing. And of course, this, so this is teaching us, what is this doing? So this is teaching us when we are truncating things in a particular way, what is the functional form of the mistake that we're making? I think this is a very useful thing to always be able to know, right? So if you're doing some other kind of approximation like cola taking only a few steps, it would be nice to understand. And I think we're going to, you can also understand this by then running the simulation with much better resolution and comparing, and that's good. But if you also have some understanding of where it comes from, maybe that's what inspires you to, I should put more steps, or instead of doing more steps, do this or that. I don't know. It's just a question of how you get the idea.
So I have just a quick question. So what is the minimum and what is the maximum of your error at KF.01?
Something like this. Let's do P error over P, so that it's like. This is just in a given realization, right? The difference between, it's like very small. But eventually we are getting. Now, I don't know that we believe that the simulation is correct to this level. So it might well be that. The parameters that we are using are not the ones of the real universe because. So I'm just saying that the simulation. So, for example, if the simulation was not conserving mass and momentum, which in some cases, it would lead to mistakes that you cannot reabsorb in these particular, coefficients assume that you're conserving mass and momentum, and if you're not. Which, for example, I believe Gadget does not do it it doesn't do it exactly. And there's this place where it switches from grid to tree, then it leads to some problems. And so there's a numerical parameter there that if you change it, you can screw things up.
Anyway, this is clearly a topic which is generating a lot of excitement, and it will probably be a theme that will continue through the discussion.